two men. And I pray, Lord God, that you would bless both their ministries and that you would keep them safe. And Lord God, they would be able to report the truth. We get so little these days. I pray, Lord God, that the delusion of this age would pass this night and we would see clearly. I ask for your grace and mercy. In the blessed name of our Messiah, Yeshua, Jesus. Amen.
I thank you for coming especially tonight because we are in such exhilarating times. And I thought that a real good analogy of what I've been thinking over the last couple weeks is Plato's cave. Do you remember, did you read Plato's Republic when you were in college? Mm-hmm. And did you read the analogy of the cave where Socrates explains that people who are not involved in philosophy, who are not thinking about the great questions, who are not trying to learn about the truth of things, are like people who live in a cave and have lived there all their lives, and they have their backs to the light and they watch shadows on the wall. And they have names for the various shadows on the wall, and they are very involved with the shadows. And then he likens learning philosophy to coming out of the cave into the bright sunlight. And you can suddenly see the reality of the things behind the shadows. And he says that there are some people who prefer the cave and the shadows. Well, what we have been living in since January 20th is Plato's cave and the emergence from it. I was asked on the way over here, how do you feel since January 20th? And I said, every day is Christmas. Something else happens that's wonderful. That is, it's so extraordinary, I can't believe it. After 8 years, even I had gotten used to the idea. There's nothing we can do, or at very least, nothing is going to be done. And we're all just going to slide down into destruction and defeat. And now suddenly, there's this huge pushback. But we do see there are a great many people who prefer the cave and the shadows to the reality of things. And so this is not going to be easy. But imagine if Hillary Clinton had been president right now. And we would just be continuing on that same inexorable, apparently inexorable slide to the dissolution of Judeo-Christian civilization, to the destruction of the United States, and to the extinguishing of free societies in the world for an unknowable period. And now there's hope. I can barely see for the bright sunlight. And I love it. I hope you do too, and are not longing for the cave and the shadows. But if you are, we do have security men here tonight. So, I've been asked to speak about a couple of ways in which this is playing out. And in one of them, in the first one, it's really rather inconclusive as to how and when we're going to see the reality of things. It's only that we have been promised by President Trump that things are going to turn around. And that is in regard to Israel and the United Nations Resolution 2334. And I'm sure that you're all familiar with it. It was an extraordinary betrayal of a faithful ally by the Obama administration in its last days. The UN has passed many similar resolutions over the years, condemning Israel for doing things that were perfectly legitimate in terms of Israel's right to self-defense and ownership of the land on which it is based. And the United States would always veto them. But, of course, as you all know, the United States did not veto this and allowed it to pass. It passed actually unanimously in the UN Security Council, a prohibition, a criminalization of any Israeli construction on any land that was won in the 1967 war. Now, that is an extraordinary document, because it essentially is saying that the parts of Jerusalem that include the Temple Mount and the Western Wall actually are occupied Palestinian land. And this is in line with a UNESCO resolution from a few months ago that actually did say that. That said that the Temple Mount is Palestinian. It is not a Jewish site. Now, anybody who's been there and anybody who's studied any of the history of the region or anybody who's opened a Bible will know that there is no more Jewish site than the site of the Temple of Solomon and the previous temple. There is no more Jewish site than Jerusalem in general. And the United Nations is now on record declaring that those are not Jewish sites. They do not belong to Israel, and Israel is violating international law if it builds on those sites. This is an outrage to history, to reason, to truth, as well as to international law as it has previously been established in numerous ways. The whole of that area was marked out for Jewish settlement by the League of Nations after the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire in World War I, after World War I. Not only that, but the countries that Israel defeated in 1967 were all determined to destroy Israel utterly. And Israel took over those territories in order to protect itself and with a perfectly legitimate right of self-defense and of the right of conquest in wartime. The right of conquest in wartime is something that has been universally recognized for every country in the world, everywhere in history, all over the globe, except for Israel. Do you know the great, since I started out talking about a philosopher, I'll mention another, the philosopher, the German philosopher from the 18th century, Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant was born and died in the German city of Königsberg, which was an ancient German city going back to medieval times. And he lived there all his life. He never left there. And oddly enough, because he was kind of an eccentric, he made part of his living giving travelogues, and they were very popular. People would come from all over to hear him describe various sites. Rome, the Vatican, Jerusalem, wherever. He had been all over, and he knew all about them, except he hadn't. He'd never been anywhere outside Königsberg. He just read books about them. And what if you wanted to go to Königsberg today? You can't. It does not exist. It is Kaliningrad in Russia. Why? Because Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union defeated him and took over a great deal of German territory. After World War II, it was assigned to Russia, to Poland, and to other states. Nobody raises a murmur of protest. There is no right that Germans have to claim Königsberg as a German city. Hitler was embarked on an evil scheme, and as evil as the Soviets were, they won that city fair and square. And they still hold it. Nobody would say a thing about it. And there are thousands, literally thousands of examples like that I could give you. But when it comes to Israel, suddenly that's off the table. When that is real international law, the United Nations has been around since 1945, but nations have been around since time immemorial. And that's always how things have been settled. What's more, of course, the 8 mile wide border at its slimmest extent that Israel would have without some of the lands from when in 1967 would essentially guarantee the eventual destruction of Israel. I mean, 8 miles that you have to defend. So one mistake and you're done for. And at least the country is bisected and dismembered and ultimately destroyed altogether. And so, President Trump, of course, before he... Isn't that nice to say? I like to say that, President Trump. You know, 8 years, I would always refer to Barack Obama. I never once referred to President Obama. Now, you can say, oh, no, Spencer, you're wrong, because I read an article that you said President Obama. Some editor put that in. I never once wrote it or said it. But President Trump, doesn't that sound nice? And it's not that... you know, he's got an especially winning personality or morally upright background. It's that he's actually doing things to defend the United States. And it's so, it's, well, like I say, the sun is so bright. I'm blinking to try to see the reality of things. Now, it's very important that he keeps his word on this and repudiates that resolution and defends Israel at the UN, or if he even better defunds the UN and gets it out of America, then what we need to do in any case is very much strengthen that alliance and reaffirm our commitment to the safety and the continued existence of Israel. Now, this is not just a matter of loyalty to an ally, and not just a matter of doing what is right by any other nation, particularly one with which we are allied, but it's also an essential aspect of our defense against the global jihad. The war against Israel is a jihad. A jihad is a struggle to establish Islamic law over a land on which it is not yet established. That's what jihad is all about. It's not just about blowing things up for the fun of it. It's about destabilizing non-Muslim governments so that they ultimately fall and are replaced with Muslim state, Muslim governments, Islamic law governments. Israel, of course, in the Islamic view, has no right to exist and will never have any right to exist because of what is written in the Quran. So you would open your Qurans to chapter 2, verse 191. You didn't bring it. It's okay, I brought mine. I read the Quran so you don't have to.
Thank you.
Chapter 2, verse 191 is one of the most charming verses in this most cuddly of books. Kill them whenever you find them and drive them out from where they drove you out. It's very simple. Kill them wherever you find them and drive them out from where they drove you out. Drive them out from where they drove you out is actually the key part of this for our concern, our purposes tonight. Drive them out from where they drove you out means that no land that has ever belonged to Muslims or been ruled by Muslims can ever legitimately, in the eyes of Islam, be ruled by non-Muslims. Drive them out from where they drove you out. It's a very simple principle. So see, if, for example, the Muslims had a caliphate in Spain and the non-Muslims drove them out, well, then the Muslims have a responsibility before Allah, delineated in the Quran, commanded in the Quran, to drive out the non-Muslims from Spain and re-establish Islamic rule. And it's the same situation for Israel. And actually, when you read, Al-Qaeda in particular is exercised about Spain, but ISIS, the Islamic State, has also written about it. And it is a very high element, item, on the jihadi wish list. They want to destroy Israel, and then they want to reconquer Spain. Because it's in the Quran. Drive them out from where they drove you out. It couldn't be simpler. This is Allah speaking to the Muslims. This is something they have to do in order to please Allah. So when there are Camp David Accords and Oslo Accords and roadmaps and everything else that has been attempted to try to bring peace between Israel and the Palestinians, they are all doomed to failure before they even start. And they will never, ever work. They will never bring peace, because there will always be Muslims in that area who believe they have a responsibility before their God to drive them out from where they drove you out. And so what is the solution? The solution is only to be strong, to understand this, to unapologetically assert and insist that this is land that is the land of Israel, and be determined to defend it. But understand, this is not something that's going to be solved. Now, you know, we want a solution. TV shows are 30 minutes long or an hour long, and we want it all to be wrapped up by the end. But there is just no solution to this problem. There's only management of it. And the only management of it can come from military, cultural, spiritual, societal strength. If any one of those is missing, then there's going to be trouble. And one of the reasons why we have so much trouble is that many of those elements have been missing in whole or part, on the part of many Israelis as well as on the part of the American left. And so the first key to any kind of solution for Israel in terms of any kind of way that it can continue to exist in safety and security is to understand that all these negotiations and peace efforts are the wrong way to go. Now, Donald Trump has not shown any indication of being aware of this, but he has shown a strong determination to defend Israel and to keep the jihadis from encroaching further upon it. But it was very disquieting when the other day it came out a very strange statement from his press secretary that was one of the few sour notes and equivocal notes that we have heard from this White House since January 20th. And that was that it was sort of a strange thing. You remember it said, maybe those settlements aren't such a good idea. Maybe they are an obstacle to peace. And then it said, the president is not intending to make here an official statement on the settlements. So that's good. We have a little bit of breathing room, but it was not a good sign. What the president, I hope, will do is look at the example of even recent history. 10 years ago, we were told that Gaza was in ferment and on fire because Israelis were there establishing settlements, and it was Palestinian land. And the Israelis agreed, which they really never ought to do. And they left and forcibly dismantled those settlements. And the American publisher Mortimer Zuckerman spent $14 million to buy greenhouses that the Israelis had established in Gaza and gave them to the Palestinians so that they would be able to have gainful employ, have something to occupy their time. The idea was, Zuckerman clearly thought, and many, many other people clearly thought, that if the Israelis go, if they end the occupation, if they stop the settlement construction, then the Palestinians will be pacified, they will stop the war, they will go about their business, they will start to pursue peaceful occupations, and they have these greenhouses they can work in, they have other things they can do. What did they do? They immediately gutted the greenhouses and made them into weapon smuggling tunnels. The outpoint of many of the weapon smuggling tunnels from the Sinai was these greenhouses. And they only stepped up the jihad against Israel. It didn't lessen. They didn't stop fighting the Israelis. They started lobbing rockets into Israel. So that Israel has several times now had to go in to Gaza. And then immediately we always hear, excuse me, how disproportionate the Israeli response is and so on. There's nothing disproportionate about dealing with a people that wants to destroy you utterly. I am not in the slightest bit saying that the Palestinians should be destroyed utterly. But to take measures that appear to be harsh or are portrayed as harsh, and of course the grievance propaganda industry in Gaza is very strong and sophisticated and has continually been found to have manufactured atrocities by the IDF, and then they go out into the international news, and it's only much later we find out that the whole thing was fake. But in any case, reality is sometimes difficult. And this is a group, if you look at the Middle East Media Research Institute or Palestinian Media Watch, and you see what they see on TV all the time in Gaza, you would be amazed at the open calls for genocide of the Jews, the open anti-Semitism, the hatred and the venom that is so very deep. And it ultimately goes back to the Quran, which not only says drive them out from where they drove you out, but if you turn to chapter 5, verse 82, it says that the Jews, among all people, will be the worst enemies of the Muslims, which in practice generally works out to being that the Muslims are the most hostile to the Jews. And they see them as some sort of subhuman beasts that are deeply evil. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, the famous ex-Muslim feminist, grew up a Muslim in Somalia. And then later she immigrated to Europe and speaks about seeing Jews for the first time and being shocked and seeing they're just ordinary people. She thought they were sort of gargoyles in semi-human form, stalking around, doing evil on the earth. And this is what these people are told all the time. Exactly this kind of thing. If you look at the Quran's teaching on the Jews, it says that they are under a curse of Allah for claiming that Ezra is the son of God, which of course they don't. Chapter 9, verse 30 of the Quran. It says that humiliation and disgrace follows them wherever they are, which is chapter 2, verse 89. And this is something that becomes a responsibility incumbent upon the Muslims to make sure if Jews are not living humiliated and disgraced, then the Muslims have to make sure that they are, because it's in the Quran. If humiliation and disgrace follow them wherever they are, then if they don't have it, it has to be brought upon them. They essentially are haters of Allah, haters of the good, the killers of the prophets, and the enemies of the Muslims that are most skillful and indefatigable and inveterate. Against this backdrop, if somebody's reading this book then as the eternal and perfect words of the one and only God, then how are you going to see some negotiated settlement? How are you going to see the existence of Israel at all? It has to be destroyed. And so it is good to see that we have a president now, for the first time in so very long, who is interested in defending Israel. I hope that people around him will be telling him some of these things so that we don't continue to waste our time on peace accords that are never going to do anything and have all too often been used to force concessions upon the Israelis that are dangerous for their own security and continued survival. But that instead we will devote our efforts and our resources to genuine steps that can defend Israel. The other thing... excuse me. The other thing that is, of course, very large in the news these days is the President Trump's immigration ban, his Muslim ban, as it's being called. 87% of the Muslims in the world are not affected by it. And yet it is being completely demonized and vilified as a Muslim ban. The people who prefer the shadows of Plato's cave to reality are ignoring some very important facts in trying to vilify this ban and get it done away with altogether. And of course, right now it's not in effect. The a federal judge called for it to be halted, and then the Justice Department, President Trump's Justice Department, has challenged that ban and called for a stay on the ban of the ban. And they're going to be fighting about this for a long time. But actually, American law is quite explicit and very clear that the president has the right and the responsibility to make immigration restrictions of any kind without any kind of exception made in that law in order to safeguard the security of the American people. Now, is keeping people out from places like Yemen and Somalia a good idea? And does it have to do with national security? Or is it just a racist, bigoted, anti-Muslim step that shows that the alt-right neo-Nazi white supremacists have taken over Washington and the sky is falling? We need to look at reality in order to answer that question. And it's really very simple. The Islamic State, as ISIS calls itself, you remember ISIS or ISIL as the former president used to call it, and the former president. And that group actually calls itself the Islamic State. Since June 29th, 2014, has proclaimed itself to be the sole legitimate government for Muslims on earth and indeed for non-Muslims, the Caliphate, the successor of Muhammad. The caliph is the successor of Muhammad as the military, political, and spiritual leader of the Muslims. And this entity now occupies a large expanse of Iraq and Syria. At its highest point, it occupied a land larger than Great Britain. And it, because of its claim to be the caliphate, which has been endorsed by many other Muslim groups, it also has allegiance of groups that hold significant expanses of land in Libya, in Nigeria, in Yemen, and elsewhere. It is an international movement, and it has declared war on the United States in no uncertain terms. In September 2014, it issued a lengthy fatwa, a religious ruling, explaining why it was the Muslims' duty to kill Americans and to kill others. It especially singled out what it called the spiteful and filthy French. And we saw again an attack at the Louvre in Paris just days ago. And it said that you are to kill Americans and kill other Western non-Muslims in any way that you can. Use an IED. If you don't have an IED, then shoot them. If you don't have a gun, then stab them. If you don't have a knife, run them over with your car. And we've seen a lot of that. There's been a lot of that in Israel as well. Now, this group, the Islamic State, in calling for the murders of American civilians, also made it very clear. In February 2015, it said, we are going to flood Europe with 500,000 refugees. They said it straight out. We're going to flood Europe with 500,000 refugees. Now, 500,000 refugees, what would that do to Europe? Well, we're seeing, because they came. What a coincidence. And what would they do to Europe? Well, first thing they would do is overwhelm the welfare systems of those welfare states, because they don't come and work. Because the Quran in chapter 9, verse 29, you can turn there, it says that Muslims must fight against the people of the book, who are primarily Jews and Christians, until they pay the jizya, a tax, with willing submission and feel themselves subdued, which is essentially saying that in the proper scheme of things, it's the responsibility of Jews and Christians to pay for the upkeep of the Muslims, to pay this tax that supports the Muslims. And so if the non-Muslims are not paying the tax, the Muslims have the right to take their resources by theft or to take advantage of their welfare systems and so on. So they're not working and they're overwhelming the welfare systems, but above all, they are engaging in all kinds of behavior that is creating tremendous upheaval in European societies. For one thing, in November 2015, Islamic jihadis attacked at several points in Paris and murdered 130 people. All of those attackers, it did not come out immediately, but it has now been established that every last one of those attackers was a refugee who had just come into Europe. And so you think about, well, the Islamic State said we're going to send refugees. They were going to embed jihadis among the refugees, and they have done so. Not only that, but the refugees have committed an absolute pandemic of rapes and sexual assaults. Now, this is very unpleasant, but it's all in the Quran. This is based upon the Quran. If you turn to chapter 4, verse 3, I don't know why you don't have it. I take mine wherever I go. Anyway. says, marry the women that seem good to you. Two or three or four. And then, it says, if you fear that you will not be able to treat them justly, then marry one. Or from among those your right hands possess. Who are those your right hands possess? Well, I happen to have here... I like to carry this one around. You can see I've carried it around a lot. Because this is a certified moderate Quran. And we need to empower the moderates. You've all heard that. And I was in London. I can't go there anymore because I committed the crime of saying that Islam has a doctrine of violence against unbelievers. Yeah. Stay tuned to see if the Prime Minister of Great Britain will start banning people who say that water is wet. But in any case... I was in London a few years back, and I did what any American tourist would do in London. I toured the mosques. And so I was at the Finsbury Park Mosque, which was notorious a few years back. Abu Hamza was the imam there. He was a very notorious character. You may have seen pictures of him. He had, at one point, in an excess of piety, blown himself up. And he had lost his eye and both of his hands. So he had this strange white eye with no pupil and hooks for hands. And he was the imam at this mosque, and they preached jihad terror. He is now in prison in the United States for his part in a conspiracy to establish an Al-Qaeda training camp in Bly, Oregon. And anyway, Abu Hamza's gone now. He was gone when I went there. And I said to the very nice young man who was loading me up with books, hoping to convert me to Islam. It didn't work. And he was very friendly, very courteous. And I said, I hear you had some trouble here a few years back. And he said, yes, yes, there were some extremists here, but they're all gone. And now we're all moderates. All of them. And so he gave me this moderate Quran. This Quran is a translation of the Arabic text with commentary by Sayyid Abu Ala Maududi. Maududi was a Pakistani Islamic scholar and politician. He was the founder of Jamaat-e-Islami, which is still the largest political party in Pakistan that wants to establish the fullness of Islamic law. Maududi died in 1979, and his works on the Quran, he wrote a multi-volume commentary on the Quran, of which this is a digest, and his works on the Quran, you can find it. Next time you go to your local Muslim bookstore, ask for books by Maududi. I guarantee you they will have them. He's not considered extremist. He's very mainstream. And so when you go in, remember Maududi. Anyway, I'm going to let him explain what the captives of the right hand, those whom your right hands possess, are. There are several other verses. I won't take your time to read them all, but there are several other verses relating to these people that it makes it clear that a Muslim man can have sexual relations with them, even though he is not married to them. And this is what he says, Maududi. This expression, the those whom your right hands possess, denotes slave girls, i.e. female captives of war, who are distributed by the state among individuals when no exchange of prisoners of war takes place. Now, you may have heard ISIS doing this and kidnapping large numbers of Yazidi and Christian girls and using them in this way. And it's the same thing in Europe, where you also have the Quran verse, chapter 33, verse 59. You remember that one. I'm sure you have it needle-pointed on your wall. it says, O Prophet, enjoin your wives and your daughters and the believing women to draw a part of their outer garments over them. It is likelier that they will be recognized and not molested. Recognized, that is, as Muslims, if they're all covered up, and not molested. So you see, the women who are not going to be molested have to be veiled, have to have their heads covered, their faces covered, whatever. But if you are not thus covered up, then you can be molested. That's the subtext here, that if you don't want your if you want to be molested, then don't dress in this way. Don't draw a part of your outer covering over them. So these Muslim guys come into Europe, and they see these women who are not all veiled, and they think these are non-Muslim women. Non-Muslim women can be taken as captives of the right hand, and they're not veiled, so they can be molested. And so this is the rape epidemic in Germany, in Sweden. It's Sweden is now the rape capital of the world because of Muslim migrants. So President Trump, you remember, President Trump, he wants to keep this kind of thing from happening here. And one of the very sparsely reported but extraordinary aspects of his ban on these countries, and that's only a beginning. A lot of people say, well, wait a minute, why wasn't Saudi Arabia, why wasn't Afghanistan, a lot of countries ought to be added to the list. And that's some good news that Reince-Priebus, his chief of staff, did say recently that some countries may be added to the list. But first they have to establish that the list can be done at all, that we have any right to defend ourselves. But the extraordinary thing about the executive order is that it says that the United States should and must keep people out who want to put religious law over civil law, who want to have bring over practices such as honor killings and the violence against people who are of a different religion or violence against women. Now, of course, Islam justifies all those things. And so it was very clear what it was all about. And the idea that the United States could keep those people out and should keep those people out, it's very simple. It's either do that or face the kind of societal upheaval that we're seeing in Europe and will be seeing in Europe for years to come. Either we keep out some people who are legitimate travelers and will not cause any trouble, or we bring in people among whom will be an unknowable number of Islamic Jihad mass murderers and people who believe in Islamic law to the extent that they will take women and molest them and go on welfare and never do any good for anybody, and they will cause immense disruption to American society. It's an either or. You either inconvenience some people who are perfectly nice folks, or we bring upon ourselves a future of mass murder and societal upheaval. Now you say, well, that's an oversimplification. Well, is it really? Yes, because you can vet the refugees, and even President Trump has said, we're going to do extreme vetting. I don't know what that means. It sounds good, though. Yeah. And the only problem about it is that, and I think this ultimately is going to have to be faced by Trump or some future American president, how are you going to vet these people? Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, said, war is deceit, yes, and gave permission to lie if a husband needs to lie to his wife to keep the marriage smooth. No, honey, I wasn't out with the captives of the right hand last night. And in wartime. And of course, the Islamic State and other jihadi entities consider themselves to be at war with the United States. So war is deceit. So how can you vet for people if they're going to lie, no matter what question you ask them? Exactly. Not only that, but we've already seen the failure of the Obama vetting process. Tashfeen Malik, one of the San Bernardino shooters who killed 15 people at a Christmas party on December 2nd, 2015, she had passed 5 separate background checks from 5 different U.S. agencies. Now, this doesn't mean that nothing can be done. I think that if you did have some kind of questioning regarding support for Israel, regarding the attitudes toward women, toward honor killings, toward some of the things that were enumerated in the executive order, if they were properly phrased and administered by people who were knowledgeable, then they might be very revealing. Because even the most practiced deceiver, and the Quran tells us that Allah is the best of schemers, even the most practiced deceiver cannot cover for things he's not prepared to lie about. And so if the questions were cleverly enough crafted, there may be something that could be done. But in any case, in the short term, is a moratorium justified? Yes. It's obviously quite justified by law, justified by necessity, justified by the statements of the jihad entities, justified by the record of what's happened in Europe, justified by the teachings of Islam in regard to not only the things that I've enumerated already, but also the concept of, excuse me, I'm 13 years old, the concept of emigration in general. Emigration, moving from one land to another, is actually central in Islam. It's a central Islamic concept. It's not tangential or incidental. It is central. As a matter of fact, the Islamic calendar, do you know what the year one of the Islamic calendar is? The Hijra. It's not when Muhammad was born. Excuse me. It's not when Muhammad died. It's not when Muhammad became a prophet. It's the Hijra. The Hijra is the emigration, when Muhammad moved from Mecca to Medina and became for the first time a military and political leader as well as a spiritual one. And so the idea of making that year one in the Islamic calendar is tacitly saying Islam is not really Islam until it's political and military and not just religious. That's one point. But it's also established as being political and military by means of immigration. Chapter 4, verse 100 of the Quran says, He who emigrates in the way of Allah will find in the earth enough room for refuge and plentiful resources. And he who goes forth from his house as a migrant in the way of Allah and his messenger, and whom death overtakes, his reward becomes incumbent on Allah. Now in the Quran, in Islam, there's no savior, there's no redemption, they're just the scales. If your good deeds outweigh your bad deeds, you go to paradise. If your bad deeds outweigh your good deeds, you go to hell. And so when there's something that's promised a reward from Allah, that's extremely important, because that's a big thing on your good deed scale, to emigrate in the way of Allah. But emigrating in the way of Allah does not mean moving to the United States to get a good job and send money back to Pakistan. Moving in the way of Allah, emigrating in the way of Allah, means you are bringing Islam to the new place. That's what it's all about. And that means everything that it means. The subjugation of the infidels, the subjugation of women, the extinguishing of the freedom of speech, the honor violence, much more. If you bring that to a new land, you will be rewarded by Allah. Now, do any Muslims take this seriously in the United States? Let me give you, I will close with one example. A few years back, there was a school in Minnesota called the Tariq Ibn Zayed Academy. It was a charter school, which means it received federal funds, and yet it was essentially an Islamic school. All the students were Muslims, they had Quran class, they had prayers. And so, eventually, a controversy began, because, of course, the prayer in school is supposed to be not allowed, and religious schools are not supposed to receive government funding. This has all been established vis-a-vis Christianity over the years. And so this school was challenged, and ultimately it was shut down, and ultimately it reopened in the same place under another name, and it's doing the same things, but that's another story. The point I'm making here is that in all that controversy about Tariq Ibn Zayed Academy, I did not see one story where one reporter had the wit or curiosity to ask someone there, hey, who's Tariq Ibn Zayed? Is he the John Dewey of Islam, some great educator? Tariq Ibn Zayed was one of the conquerors of Spain. And he's famous for landing on the beach in Spain and ordering the boats burned. And his soldiers said, what are you doing burning the boats? And he said, we're here to stay. We either die here or we establish Islam here, but we ain't going back. Now, what do you think the people in Minnesota who called Salt thought, hey, let's call it Tariq Ibn Zayed Academy. What do you think they have in mind? So, it's extraordinary the times we're living in. And I think it's going to be very difficult. Obviously, there's no doubt it's going to be very difficult. But for the first time in so many years, we have pushback, actual attempts to defend Americans against the global jihad. And I don't mean just 8 years. I mean quite a bit longer than that. President Trump is more honest when he speaks, even when he says the words radical Islamic terrorism. President Trump is more honest about the nature, the motivating ideology of the jihad threat than any president since John Quincy Adams. And John Quincy was not a candidate in 2016. So what's happened now is extraordinary. The move toward globalization, the erasure of national boundaries, the erasure of ethnic distinctions, and the establishment of a socialist internationalist order was just moving along swimmingly. And now suddenly a wrench has been thrown in the works. Amen. The people who love that machine, the people who love the shadows, they are clearly very riled up, and they're going to keep coming. But remember, the first rule always in confronting bullies, confronting evil, Stand up to them. If you stand up and refuse to cede an inch, then they're the real cowards. They will run away. And ultimately, I think that, I'm more optimistic than I've been in years. We have a chance to prevail and preserve free societies now. But we all have to work and recognize that it's not all just going to be handed to us now that we have a president who has a modicum of sense and is not a globalist determined to destroy nation states and so on. We have to work harder than ever to make sure that the forces of oppression, the forces of darkness, are not going to prevail after all. And are not going to make this just a wonderful interlude before it's back to the cave. We will never go back to the cave again. Thank you. And so now, the extraordinary and estimable Mr. Joel Richardson. My name is Robert Spencer. I'm the director of Jihad Watch, a program of the David Horowitz Freedom Center, and a consultant for the Investigative Project on Terrorism and the Center for Security Policy. I'm the vice president of the American Freedom Defense Initiative and the author of 16 books, including the New York Times bestsellers, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades, and The Truth About Muhammad. My latest book is The Complete Infidel's Guide to Iran, available now at any self-respecting bookstore.
Robert Spencer approved that.
Essentially, what we're going to do now, so we're at 7:20, and we've got until about 9, is shift, essentially do Q&A. Is Robert extremely enjoyable to listen to?
This is a wonderful place. I thank you for having me back, and it's good to see you all again.
My question is if, hypothetically speaking, the Islamic State is destroyed in Iraq and Syria, do you think that would be the high watermark of Islamic Jihad?
I think it would be wonderful if the Islamic State were destroyed in Iraq and Syria, and it would be a tremendous blow to the jihadis. The evidence for that actually comes from Osama bin Laden himself and Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. You remember Zarqawi from Iraq, al-Qaeda in Iraq, about 10 years ago? He was the notorious leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. He was killed by an American strike around 2006. And Zarqawi actually is, in a certain sense, the founder of ISIS, the Islamic State, because al-Qaeda in Iraq became the Islamic State. He wanted to establish, even back then, a caliphate in Iraq. And he was in correspondence with Osama bin Laden about it. And Osama bin Laden said, yes, we want a caliphate in Iraq, but this is not the right time. If we establish it now, if you establish it now, the Americans will come in and destroy it, and it will be a tremendous defeat for Islam. And so Zarqawi, he didn't like that answer. And he himself got killed, but his group continued and established, in defiance of al-Qaeda, which is why they split, he established the caliphate in Iraq in 2014. And so far, he's been proven correct. The Americans did not go in and topple it. And the very fact of its existence is considered by Muslims worldwide, many Muslims worldwide, as being evidence there really is the caliphate because Allah is blessing and perpetuating it. And so 30,000 Muslims from around the world have gone to Iraq and Syria to join it. Now, if President Trump actually goes in and destroys it, as he has repeatedly announced his determination to do, then Osama bin Laden will be proven right, that the Americans came in and toppled it, and it would be a tremendous defeat for Islam. Allah did not protect his caliphate, and the whole thing came to naught. And so, certainly, if we went in, I don't think we should engage in the futile Wilsonian nation-building that doomed the project previously. But if we went in, toppled the caliphate, and got out, it would be a tremendous setback for the jihadis, even while all the media would be saying, oh, this will embolden them even further. We must not do anything to defend ourselves. You notice they always say, you can't do this, it'll make them mad. But they're not mad now.
You know, it's funny to look back to where, you know, where we are now, and I don't know how many years back when we initially went into Iraq and you heard President Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney saying, you know, we need to do this in Iraq, because if we don't, you know, Al-Qaeda, they want to establish a caliphate. I'm trying to do my George Bush. But and to the degree to which the left-wing media just went nuts, and they said this is the new right-wing scaremonger term, you know, the caliphate. There's no such thing as a caliphate. No one's going to establish a caliphate. And suddenly, 2014, we have a caliphate. And I made the joke at the time. I said 10 years ago, I was predicting that by now we'll probably have a caliphate. 10 years ago, Al Gore was saying by this time all of the polar ice caps would be melted. We have a caliphate. But what's interesting in terms of the evolution of popular thought, I guess, is, you know, so you have this mandate within Islamic law, and of course it's being championed by folks like Osama bin Laden and so forth, but you have this mandate to establish this Islamic government. So when you say, what is a caliphate, just think religious, military, political, pope, president, general, all sort of wrapped up into one office, that being the caliph, and the government, his kingdom, if you will, being the caliphate. Well, so it's been viewed, I mean, if you read a lot about this, primarily as something that Osama bin Laden, these guys want to set up. Well, what I've seen in the past few years, now that there is a caliphate, is suddenly you start seeing commentary by different Western analysts that say, you know something, maybe we need to rethink the concept of the caliphate. Maybe the reason the whole Middle East is such a mess is because of the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire, because of the dissolution of the Ottoman Caliphate. So I think it's pretty inevitable that we'll see the downfall of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Of course, there is the reality that you still have Libya and the Sinai and Boko Haram and Abu Sayyaf and all these various groups all over the world that still are sort of swearing allegiance to it. But what I suspect long term that we'll see is we'll see all these well-meaning, far better educated than myself, Western analysts that will say, you know something, what we really need, what the people have revealed is that they do desire a caliphate, but what we need is a much more moderate, modern, progressive caliphate. Maybe something that would be led by the Turks, you know, a much more cultured version of Islam. And I think we'll increasingly see folks that will say, yes, that's what will restore order to the Middle East. And so, you know, it's easy for the world to look at ISIS and go, this is horrible. But when you start presenting sort of a more moderate version of it, I think that's, in the longer term, that's actually the greater danger. Because then you give that collective power to one leader, and you've got so many different more moderate, so-called, you know, moderate nations throughout the earth coming under the, you know. And I think prophetically, there's probably a pretty solid case for that as well. So I don't know if that necessarily answered part of what you're asking, but long term, that's what I suspect that we'll see.
This is also closer to fruition than many people realize, because Turkey is ruled by Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president who was previously prime minister. He's been in power for a very long time, and he has made it abundantly clear in numerous ways that he is no fan of secularism, of the Kemalist philosophy that has been in power in Turkey since the 1920s. And he believes in Islamic government. He has been systematically dismantling Kemalism and reestablishing Islamic government in Turkey. It is widely believed, with very good reason, that the coup attempt against him a few months ago was actually staged by him in order to give him a pretext to round up the remaining enemies that he has and to consolidate his power entirely. He's also been frequently accused, not without reason, of wanting to reestablish the Ottoman Caliphate, and has frequently been criticized, again, not without reason, for not acting, even though he's a NATO ally of the United States, against ISIS. Now, why would he not want to move against the Islamic State? If you consider, it doesn't take very long to figure it out. If he really wants to reestablish the caliphate, but put it back in Istanbul, where it was under the Ottomans. And here is this group in Syria fighting against Bashar Assad, who he hates, because Assad is an Alawite and not a legitimate Muslim in his eyes, and the Kurds, who he hates because they want their independent state and he wants to reestablish the Ottoman Empire. They're fighting against his enemies. They're doing his job for him. They're pulling his chestnuts out of the fire, as they used to say. So he is hoping, it seems pretty clear to me, to ultimately co-opt the gains that they have made and reestablish his own rule in those areas as he attempts to co-opt their caliphate and move it to Istanbul.
In fact, let me just add something to that real quick before. And this will be the interesting factor with regard to Trump, is to say, it, you know, there's obviously many things that he's doing that are fantastic, but, you know, essentially what Robert just presented the case for is that there is some wisdom in a restrictive immigration policy, but of course, then if that's the case, then why not every Islamic nation? And I don't suspect that we'll see any immigration restrictions from Saudi Arabia or Turkey and so forth. And so the question with regard to Trump is, will he maintain the status quo, you know, the approach that we've been doing in terms of relating to Turkey, which is an emerging fascist, nationalist, imperialist dictatorship? Are we going to continue to relate to them as though this is still the old secular bridge nation and so forth? And what will his relationship be with the Saudis? And that's critical. So, yes, there's definitely some good things that are being done in the political realm, but there's also a lot that's still continuing as it has been for the past 20 years.
One other thing, too, I'm sorry, but one extraordinary thing about President Trump is that he keeps saying these things that indicate that he has some real insight when you wouldn't ever expect it. I don't mean any insult to the man, but, you know, he's been a reality TV host, and he's a billionaire, and then he says NATO is obsolete. And everybody was all upset and said, why? We need NATO. He's such an idiot. I thought, that's one of the smartest things he's ever said. NATO is obsolete. It was formed to fight the Cold War. The Cold War's over. The wall's down. So no more Soviet Union. So NATO needs to be recast to fight what we're really in now. And that would mean a realignment. That would mean understanding. Turkey is not on our side. They are not going to help us against the jihad. They have consistently refused to help us against the Islamic State for the reasons I just explained, and for others as well. And so we need a global alliance against the jihad. I hope he follows through on that and doesn't allow himself to be intimidated by the experts who know so much more all about everything than he does, and will tell him that we really need NATO. We don't. It's over. It's time for a global counter-jihad alliance that was actually possible. A few years back, Putin asked Obama to fight with him against ISIS. We could ally with Russia against ISIS, and everybody was appalled. Putin's a monster. The Ukraine, the Crimea, he's terrible. Yeah, we fought alongside Stalin to defeat Hitler. Putin is not as bad as Stalin. We can't fight alongside Putin against the jihad. That's the kind of alliance that we need to pursue now.
So you mentioned that the election of President Donald Trump was kind of like the coming out of the cave. If in France they elected Marine Le Pen, would you think that would be like the coming out of the cave for Europe?
Oh, yeah. You know, I think...
What was the term for the vile and filthy French? Would that be the equivalent?
The spiteful and filthy spiteful French, yes. I've known many. Sorry. I haven't really. The thing about Europe right now is that it's on the brink of a massive disengagement from Plato's cave. Europe could go either way right now. People have asked me for years, is Europe done for? Europe's done for, isn't it? And I would always quote the sage philosopher Yogi Berra, it ain't over till it's over. There are not Islamic states in Europe now, and maybe there never will be. If Le Pen is elected in France and Wilders is elected in the Netherlands, and the Sweden Democrats continue to grow as rapidly as they've been growing in Sweden, there will be tremendous upheaval to turn this around, but it could still be turned around. The fact is that we have not yet begun to fight, and the situation is very advanced. People don't realize how bad it is, really. And so it's going to be a very difficult fight. But even the fact that we're talking about the possibility, I remember talking to Wilders a few years ago and saying, you ought to be prime minister. I hope you'd be prime minister one day. And he said, oh, I'll never be prime minister. And he explained to me in great detail how you have to have a coalition and they'll never have enough. he might actually win enough seats to be able to have a majority of by himself as the situation grows more dire. And so what seemed impossible just a few years ago is now on the horizon. It's a very wonderful time to be alive.
Trump actually sort of paved the way for builders because I didn't think before Trump got elected that someone with hair like that could ever get in.
Yes.
Obviously it's possible.
This is the weird hair era for world leaders.
Don't typically need a microphone, but just to counter that Bush and Cheney went to Iraq much more because of weapons of mass destruction than they did the caliphate. However, my question to you is, Germany is the financial backbone of Europe. And the producer of technology, they actually produce things. How long can Germany last in under Merkel? As my brother in Germany says, Merkel took the immigrants out of compassion and they didn't spread across the world. And trust me, that just like vibrates me. But how long can Germany last?
Under Merkel. Under Merkel, Germany's dead. Merkel is the best chancellor Germany's had since Adolf Hitler, if you want Germany destroyed. Hitler ultimately was, he was known, he campaigned, he ruled as the savior of Germany, but he was actually the destroyer of Germany. And Merkel is the second destroyer of Germany. Germany seems to have some sort of strange death wish. And maybe it is penance for all the evil that Hitler brought to the world. I don't know. But Merkel has shown no indication of reversing her stand. And so she's bringing in massive numbers of people who believe that Islamic government's better than secular government, and who believe that infidel women exist for their sexual use, and who believe that non-Muslims ought to be warred against and subjugated. There's no way that Germany is not going to have a future full of blood as a result. But here again, if she loses, then they may have a shot.
You can probably tell by my accent, I'm not from round here. And
Mississippi?
I know you.
Yes, you see, right?
Yeah. And I know that you know a lot about Great Britain. And
I'm not allowed in there, you know.
No, I know. I really love my country and grew up in an area which is now a very Islamic area. And I just wonder, you said that there's hope for Europe, mainland Europe, but I wonder if you think there is that hope too for Great Britain.
Well, you know, since we're speaking about accents and geography, I was actually born in the great state of South Carolina. You might not know to look at me, but it's true. And the state motto of South Carolina is Doom Spiro Sparrow, while I breathe, I hope. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. While I breathe, I hope. I'm still here, so things could get better. And as long as there are free people in Britain, and I know there must be a few, then things could change. But it's the same situation, actually, in Britain as it is in Germany. If Theresa May remains prime minister, Britain is going to be dead as a free society in a very short time. If the conservatives are decisively repudiated, along with the liberals, and UKIP becomes the leadership, then Britain has a chance. But that doesn't even appear to be close to on the horizon. But let me tell you what's happening in Britain. It's not just, you're right, I was there in 2009 last, and I was walking around some areas of London. I could have been in Karachi. There was just no sign that it was an English place. And it's only been worse. It's only gotten worse since then. And the thing is, I was, as I have now mentioned several times, I was banned from Britain for actually saying the Home Office letter signed by Theresa May. She was the UK Home Office secretary at the time. She said that I said Islam has a doctrine of warfare against unbelievers. And this is the heinous crime that I'm too criminal to be allowed in Britain. Now, she actually reiterated this recently. And she said, that she was very proud. She was boasting in a very recent speech since she's been prime minister. She said that she kept out Pamela Geller and Robert Spencer from Great Britain, just as she acted against Abu Hamza and Abu Qatada. Well, Abu Hamza is the fellow I was explaining to you before, with the hooks for hands, who was an active jihad preacher, who would preach warfare against unbelievers, and is in prison now for trying to set up an al-Qaeda camp in the United States. She's likening me to him. I'm just a writer. I just type all day. I have never called for any violence or justified any violence or anything of the kind. I want to preserve free societies in which there is non-establishment of religion. I believe that that's a genius element of the U.S. Constitution, to have no established religion. I know in England, in Great Britain in general, there's an established religion that receives state funding. In the United States, of course, we do not have that. And now, some of you might think, well, I wish there were an established religion. I hope you don't think that. Because the fact is that however much we may know that what we believe is true, there are some people who are never going to be convinced. That is an unfortunate fact of life. And they live among us. That is another fact of life. So you have two choices. You have a society in which people who differ fundamentally on the big questions live together in peace without one trying to gain hegemony over the other. Or you have one system, one point of view that's paramount, and the other people who do not subscribe to it are deprived of certain rights as a result of its being paramount. Now, I know there are tremendous problems with secularism, and there is a real war against Christianity, certainly in the United States and in Europe. But that's really a separate question. The idea of non-establishment, I think, is the absolute prerequisite to a peaceful society in a pluralistic age in which people are going to differ on fundamental questions. Now, all that said, Theresa May likens critics of Islamic Jihad to jihad killers. And not only that, but while she said that, she's bringing in jihad preachers to Britain. I have a list of them on my website, Jihad Watch, jihadwatch.org. You can find it if you look at the search for the articles in the UK, a whole list of people who have justified murder, called for murder. There were a couple of jihad preachers from Pakistan. In Pakistan, they have blasphemy laws that are used to victimize Christians on a large scale. And there was a politician who was against the blasphemy laws. He was assassinated by a Muslim. And the Muslim has become a big hero. These two preachers, there's a mosque named after him. And these two preachers were praising him. They were not only allowed into Britain for praising this murderer and calling for murder of blasphemers, but they were welcomed at the airport by the Archbishop of Canterbury. And that's just one example. These guys stream in all the time. This is going to be the death of Britain. That they do not move against jihad, and they actually move energetically against people who are foes of jihad. Tommy Robinson, the English Defense League, I'm not justifying everything he did with the EDL, and I don't even want to get into it, but the fact is that all he was trying to do as a working-class Englishman was stand up for England as such, and Britain in general, and to defend it against Islamization, and he has been viciously persecuted by the British government. Put in jail unjustly, he came to speak at one of our events in 2012, and they jailed him, they put him in solitary confinement for months, and they arrest him for nothing. Even now, he was out with his family in a restaurant, and they came and took him away for nothing. Now, this kind of thing, they're actively trying to discourage resistance to jihad terror. That means they're going to get more jihad terror. I don't see how Britain can survive unless the whole political establishment is swept out.
We're slightly different to the rest of Europe because of our colonial history, and that's been our immigration since the late 1950s. And I think really I can see why the government do what they do, because we're all kind of, in the short term, we're all okay, but in the long term, it's in the long term where I'm sorry, but find that not little hope, really, in the long term of the future.
There's always hope.
In the UK, because of the sheer numbers of people.
You understand also the freedom of speech is the foundation of a free society. You don't have a free society if you're not allowed to criticize some individual or group. Then that individual or group can do whatever he wants. So a free society depends on the freedom of speech. Resistance to a tyrant depends on the freedom of speech. But Islamic law forbids criticism of Islam. And the British government energetically fights against criticism of Islam and people who are against jihad terror. And so they are actively aiding in the establishment of a Sharia provision in the UK. And once that one's fully established, as it very nearly is now, then all the rest will follow eventually.
I think there's a couple of things here I want to say. It's important to make some clear distinctions between what's taking place in Europe, obviously, and what's taking place here in the United States, because it's easy for folks to watch what's unfolding in Europe and imagine that it's actually happening here. And, you know, we're 20 years behind Europe in a lot of ways. But what we have is really multiple merging trends at one time. It's really the perfect storm. There's sort of philosophical, ideological trends, and then, of course, demographic trends and immigration trends, and just all sorts of things are happening at one time. So, first of all, you have the issue of European socialism, obviously, is a fairly different model than what we have here. And so, in a lot of ways, you know, it is a Ponzi scheme. Socialism requires this ever-expanding youth population to prop up the aging European, you know, retirees, and so that demands immigration. Well, of course, Europe sits on top of North Africa, you know, overwhelmingly Muslim, and then, of course, so most of the immigrants are coming from the Middle East and North Africa. Of course, the United States is in a very different situation. You know, our immigrants are largely Latino Catholics. It's a very different situation. That we, you know, we just need to acknowledge the salvation of this country is Catholic Mexico. I'm just kidding. But not to some truth to that. But of course, we don't rely on. We're you know, obviously not quite as socialist sort of economic system. But there's also the trend of the fact that, you know, we're now a couple generations into of having been brainwashed, and just our ability to think critically. And just think rationally has just been completely hamstrung through moral, cultural relativity, etc., etc. And you have, within Islam, Muslims, you know, throughout the Quran, they're repeatedly told, you are the best of people. You have the best prophet. You know, you have the best book, etc., etc. And, you know, you're the best, the best, the best. And they have this incredible sense of cultural confidence and even superiority. And they're colliding with a people who have this incredible lack of value in their collective history and so on and so forth. And, you know, even on top of that, Christian civilization is largely founded, I mean, Western civilization is largely founded on Judeo-Christianity and the biblical faith, and thus we are largely a confessional people. Even the most staunch secularist in the United States, there's a value for confessing our weaknesses, confessing our sins, etc., even to a fault, to where we don't have any sense of appreciation for the principles that, you know, in the American Constitution, equality, civil liberties, freedom, all of these things. And so here we have these people, you know, these people, we have a complete lack of cultural confidence. So first of all, we need to regain a sense of cultural superiority. Now, the problem with that is as soon as you use the word superiority, everyone hears racial superiority. We've been brainwashed to hear that. It has nothing to do with race. It has to do with saying that the principles established, certainly we have fallen short, but we aspire to these principles of, again, equality, civil liberty. They are superior to the principles in Islamic law, you know, the value, the testimony of a woman, half as good of a man, etc., etc., etc. In order to establish that a woman was raped, there must have been two male witnesses that actually witnessed. I mean, you know, it's ludicrous. So first of all, there's just a general sense of, and I don't have a lot of confidence that we're going to regain it. I really don't. But beyond that, there's the issue of the gospel. There's the issue of the church. And the question is, okay, so, you know, you look at, for instance, England, and I don't know the exact numbers of Muslims now that are in England. How many millions?
Well, I think, I'm not sure really, but it's
large
sections
of cities and towns. What's the total population
of
the UK?
It's probably about 80 million.
Okay, about 80 million. So
it's a small percentage, but, you know, they're very, very focused on certain cities and towns and
urban cores and so forth. So, yeah, so now,
in a way that you don't see anywhere like here.
Okay.
So and everybody actually gets on pretty well, which is, in a way, for the long term, part of the problem, because everything's okay, because, you know, society in the UK works very hard to make sure that, you know, we all get on. It's not like France, or our immigrants don't come from North Africa. It's the Indian subcontinent. It's slightly different. Well, very different, actually. So at the moment, it's okay. People are treading water very hard to try to make sure it is. But I guess I just think in the long term, because of the sheer numbers and the fact that they're the ones that are, you know, really having lots of children.
Right. So, of course, the adage, the future belongs to those who show up for it. You know, and again, you've got your stereotypical 50-year-old guy from Germany still living at home with mom, and on the weekend, he's not having children. It's disco, and, you know, whatnot. And, you know, and then you combine that with the immigration pop, you know, and they're exploding again. So these demographic shifts happen rapidly. But here's what I was going to say, which is, you know, that can happen fast. In 20 years, you know, the entire, it can look radically different. But you look at the numbers, and so if you've got roughly 80 million in the UK, there are approximately 3,000 or 4,000 converts to Christianity from among the Muslim population. 3,000 or 4,000. These are some estimates that I've seen. You've got a couple hundred thousand converts to Islam among Brits. So I got to think about this. Here's largely what's supposed to be a Christian nation. You've got 80 million. You've got this little teeny percentage of Muslim immigrants that come in, and they've converted a couple hundred thousand Brits, and we, at the Brits, have converted 3,000 or 4,000. The church doesn't truly have confidence in the message that we are the ambassadors and stewards of. So I think, you know, when you say, because it's very easy to hear all of this and leave and go, crap. You know, like, what did we do that for? That was depressing. But I have confidence in the gospel. I have confidence that the message that we are stewards of is the most emotionally, spiritually, just logically superior message that mankind has ever known. If the church will reclaim a sense of confidence in that message, Islam is ridiculous. But they have such incredible confidence in their message. And because of that confidence, that, you know, a lot of Christians are terrified to talk to Muslims. And yet we have the words of life that can save them, that ultimately they're crying out for. Why are they blown up? Because they're crying out to the God who's not there, who never reveals himself. He's not there. And so behind all of this, we can't leave tonight with being, you know, just depressed. You go, man, that was dark. Because there is hope. But the hope is ultimately in revival. And we can all of the political solutions and the political things that need to change, that's all very legitimate. But much more than that, we need a spiritual revolution. And there is some hope, by the way. You know, there's some move among the immigrants. I mean, you know, to a degree, Satan thought, hey, with ISIS, I'm going to do my thing. And a lot of Muslims are looking at this and going, this is gross. And, you know, there's an atheist movement and so forth. But there are many Muslims that are coming to faith. But the numbers are not significant enough yet to cause a massive, you know, cultural shift. But it's not going to happen if we don't open our mouths and start preaching the gospel and reclaim that missionary zeal.
This is very important, and I hate to inject another note of lack of hope after that very, it's very important words. But I do think it's important at the same time to know where we are and to face it as grim as it is, and then we can begin to move to where we need to be. And so when you were saying everything is okay, I just wanted to remind people that everything is only okay because people are afraid to speak. And in Britain, everything is not okay. In Britain, in one town, Rotherham, there were 1,400 girls who were brutalized and victimized by Muslim rape gangs who were basing their actions on the teachings of the Quran I outlined earlier. And that's just one town. This happened all over Britain, and authorities knew about it and covered it up because they were afraid to appear racist and Islamophobic. Now, that is a society in the midst of committing suicide. That point of view has to be eradicated. It goes exactly with what Joel's saying. If we recovered a sense of cultural confidence and took up again the fact that this is spiritual warfare, then we would challenge those authorities and say, this is an abomination that you are allowing to happen. And replace those authorities with authorities who are willing to call it what it is and take action against it accordingly.
You could speak to the obvious and growing alliance of Islam and the American left and where that's going to end up. I mean, they're so diametrically different in the true core. I can only imagine it's going to explode or they're going to kill each other or not.
I think actually, on the contrary, it's a very happy marriage that will last. And the reason why I think that is because both Islam and leftism are totalitarian in nature, at their core. You say, well, not the American left. Yeah, the American left, because the American left, you know, they walk around with Che t-shirts. Who was Che? Che was a bloodthirsty and brutal totalitarian killer in service of a communist regime that went to war against its own people. And they think he's a hero. And of course, yeah, most of those stoners who are walking around with Che t-shirts have no idea who he is. They just know it's the cool shirt to wear now, man.
Because they also have the Free Tibet stickers.
Yes. It is. Free Tibet, I'll take it. But the reality is, underneath, whenever the left has been in power, when it preaches brotherhood and equality and from each according to his ability and to each according to its needs, But when it gets into power, it enforces that by means of a Procrustean bed. This is ancient Greek night. I started with Plato, and now we're at Procrustes. Do you remember Procrustes? He was a tyrant, and he would torture his enemies. He had a bed, and he would make you lie down on his bed. And if the bed was too short for you, he would cut off your legs until you fit. And if the bed was too long for you, he would stretch you until you fit.
We are safe.
Well, we'll be stretched to death. But he made everybody fit. He made everybody the same size. That is the communist ethos, that they will establish an equal and just society in which nobody is rich and nobody is poor. Everybody's equal. And they will cut off all the limbs that don't fit. They will torture those and kill those who get out of line. From each according to his ability and to each according to his needs is actually a very frightening statement, if you think about it, because it means that the people who work are going to be stolen from to pay for the people who don't, which is, of course, what's happening here on a massive scale. And that can ultimately only be done by violence. And so they are always violent totalitarian societies that enslave and brutalize their own people, and that's the left. Now, what is Sharia, Islamic law? Islamic law is, as Joel said, the Quran says, you are the best of people. You know where it says that? It says that in chapter 3, verse 110. And it says, you are the best of people on earth. And then it goes on to say, enjoining what is right and forbidding what is wrong. You are the best of people precisely because you know what's right and wrong and they don't. And so it's the Muslims' job to tell us what's right and wrong. Now, their vision of what's right and wrong, as we have abundantly explored tonight, is abominable. It's evil. And so it consists of the same kind of thing that the left does, a Procrustean bed, a reign of terror. Sharia is a slow-motion reign of terror. They will establish the perfect society of the best of people. And if you get out of line, you'll be stoned to death, you'll be thrown off a building, you'll be beheaded, your hand will be cut off, It's a reign of terror. It's just like what the left does. So they are both violent totalitarians trying to establish a utopian society by means of violence. And so I think they're blood brothers and they're kin. And they see that, and that's why they love each other. Also, far simpler answer, they both hate America. They both hate America. They hate Judaism. They hate Christianity. They want to destroy Judeo-Christian civilization. And so they see in Islam, Christianity, and Christendom's ancient enemy. And they think, my friend, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Now, what about the fact that you have these people who are homosexuals and all these other things that Islam says put them to death? I think that the left, in that sense, does not realize what they're getting into, because leftist atheists don't understand the religious impulse of any kind. They have contempt for it. They have contempt for Christianity and Christians. They think they are easily led. Remember, even the Washington Post said years ago, famously, that Christians are poorly educated and easily led. And this is what they think of us. So they think of any religionist in the same way. They're going to be able to take care of them. Once they destroy the West, once they destroy Christianity, once they destroy America, they'll deal with these silly religionists with their funny hats. But the silly religionists with their funny hats are going to have a few surprises in store for them at that time. Khomeini had communists in his alliance when he established the Islamic Republic of Iran. And they all ultimately were killed. And the left, I think, will ultimately find that out. But even to their death, it will be a happy marriage. As the blade slices through their neck, they will be saying, I was never racist.
Yeah, I have a more interpersonal question. And I think there's different Muslims. Some are more cultural, some are more religious. For those of us, like myself, we've studied the Quran and the Hadith and the life of the Prophet and a certain number of books that you've written. And so I have a basis to understand Islam and all that. So what do you, from both of you, what do you think are the two best, say, entry points to get, say, a cultural, less religious Muslim to think about and question their faith? And what are, say, two different of the best entry points to get a more religious Muslim to think about and question their faith? Because I would guess there are certain Muslims that are just cultural and they don't even know. I mean, they probably just, they don't read the Quran, or if they do, it's in 7th century Arabic, so they don't know what's in it. So I think there's two different ways to approach those. So I was just wondering, from both of you, how do you approach those two different types the best way?
So I'm going to go back to something I said this morning, which is we are uniquely called to be the people of the cross. When was it 21 or 22 martyrs on the Libyan beach were killed, the video that ISIS made was a message to the people of the cross. I thought that was sort of a divine slip, if you will. You know, Jesus said it, the apostle Peter said it, I think Paul, I think all three of them said it, but they made reference to, don't be like the Gentiles, for they lord it over one another. There's a very natural propensity among carnal mankind to lord it over one another. You know, politicians get in power. Every position of authority in the earth is intended to be a position of servant leadership. People get in positions of power and they exploit those under them. They claw their way to the top of the pyramid until they are the most significant Amway distributor in the whole tri-state area. Whatever you name it, we're putting ourselves at the top of the pyramid. And Jesus says, don't be like the unbelievers. He says, imitate me, be a servant. And so we are uniquely called to be a people. And that's what the cross is God himself, the creator of everything, put himself at the bottom of the line. And when Muslims encounter people who genuinely model a culture of the cross, now you have Middle Eastern hospitality and all of those things. I don't want to paint, you know, Islamic culture is just purely bad. There's a lot of beauty in some of those things. But what they can't grasp is genuine sacrificial love. Mm-hmm. And whenever you meet Muslims that have come to faith, they always say, you know, you would think, well, I read the Bible and it just blew me away. And, you know, sometimes you hear that. But the most consistent reason Muslims say this is what led me to become a Christian is they go, a Christian loved me. And so, you know, we can simplify it saying being a culture of the cross is being people who are truly loving. But that's almost always going to be the thing that opens the door of any human heart and cause them to start questioning all of these things. So that would be probably this, you know, then yes, give them a Bible, pray for them, lay hands on them, attend to their needs and all those things. But certainly neglecting them is not going to be the best inroad, right?
I would add also, and this is very delicate, very difficult, and you have to do it very carefully, because remember that preaching, proselytizing in Islamic law, proselytizing another religion, is a death penalty offense. Now, a Muslim is not going to kill you in the United States for talking to him about Jesus, but you do need to be very careful to be respectful of the Quran and Islam. Doesn't mean you have to praise it in some spurious way, but not be insulting about it, certainly. And yet, at the same time, I think it's very important to try to create some cognitive dissonance. And this has led to many Muslims converting to Christianity, because the questioner was right that there are many Muslims who have no idea what's in the Quran. This is because you have to pray in Arabic. If you were to convert to Islam tomorrow, which I actually don't recommend, then you would have to, you wouldn't be able to pray right away. You'd have to pray in Arabic. If you wanted to go to the mosque, that is, and do the five daily prayers, you'd have to learn at least to mouth the syllables, because you have to pray. Allah does not listen to prayers that are not in Arabic. And you'd read the Quran in Arabic. It's not even the Quran if it's not in Arabic. So I had a Pakistani Muslim tell me, and he was quite serious. People always think this is a joke, but he was completely serious. He said, "I'm very proud of my religion, and I've memorized almost all of the Quran. And one day I intend to get one of those translations and find out what it means." He was going in, and in Pakistan, you go to a madrasa as a child, and you learn. You might memorize the whole Quran and have no idea what it's saying. You're just memorizing Arabic syllables. And so to introduce these people, whether cultural or religious, to introduce Muslims to some of the things in the Quran, just ask questions. Say, for example, that in the Quran, Jesus is born of a virgin. There's no mention of Muhammad being born of a virgin in the Quran or in Islamic tradition. In the Hadith, Islamic tradition, the words and deeds of Muhammad, Muhammad says that Jesus will return at the end of the world. He will return and make war against Christianity and break the cross. But the point here is that Jesus is the one returning, not Muhammad. And the Quran calls Jesus the Word of God. And it says that it just means by this that Allah said be, and he is. In other words, he wasn't born in the ordinary way. He's born of a virgin. But why is Jesus the Word of God and not Muhammad? And Muhammad, in another hadith, says that Jesus and his mother were the only sinless people. Now, Muhammad is essentially treated as sinless in Islam. But even the Quran, in chapter 80, verses 1 to 5, speaks about an incident where he was rude to a poor man who came to him because he was talking to the rich only. And he's rebuked by Allah for it. And so Muhammad is, strictly speaking, not sinless, but Jesus is, in Islam. And so why is that? Why is Jesus born of a virgin and the Word of God and sinless and going to return at the end of the world, and Muhammad is none of those things and yet is a greater prophet? The real answer is because the compilers of the Quran took some pieces of Christianity and put it in their mix without really understanding them. And so they left, by divine providence apparently, they left some clues and hints in there, in this book that teaches very great evils. They left some clues and hints to the fact that Jesus is actually something very much greater than a prophet. And you can ask, why is it that he has all these things? And I have known ex-Muslims who are Christians who said that they started to wonder about that, and it made them want to read the New Testament. And then one thing led to another. The other one is the injustice of Allah. Allah actually says in the Quran, if we had willed, he always refers to himself in the royal we, if we had willed, we could have saved all men, brought all men to the truth, but instead we will fill hell with jinns, these spirit beings, and men. So that's just the opposite of God wills all, wants all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. Allah does not want all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. As a matter of fact, he has deliberately misled some people in order to torture them eternally. Now, that's a monster. That's not a just God by any means. And I remember once when I was in college, this is way back in prehistory, I know, but I was talking to a Muslim, and I just asked him that because I really couldn't figure it out. Say, you say that Allah is compassionate and merciful, right? It says that at the beginning of 113 of the 114 chapters of the Quran. And he's just, right? And yet he's going to fill hell with jinns and men. And it says Allah leads astray those whom he wills and guides those whom he wills. Allah leads people astray. He actually misleads them. A pious Muslim will believe that we are here tonight because Allah has kept us from knowing the truth. Now, what kind of a just or loving God would do that? And I saw on his face, he said he's just, but he was very clearly very troubled by this. Now, the Quran also says in chapter 5, verse 101, don't ask questions. A lot of people have lost their faith by asking questions. It actually says that, chapter 5, verse 101 and 102. And so Muslims are discouraged from critical thought. But if you can move them to critical thought about things like that, then Islam falls apart. And it has happened. It does happen. But you need, in the first place, everything Joel said. You need to establish a relationship. You need to establish a certain sense of trust before you can even get there. You can't just come in and open the Quran and say these things. They'll just say that you're a hate-mongering bigot like Spencer.
I'm going to risk being politically incorrect like my President Donald Trump.
President Trump, yeah.
President Trump. I understand that under Mr. Obama, that the White House, before the swamp was cleaned up, had
the swamp is still there.
It's still swamp. That's part of this question is, I understand there were quite a few Muslims in high positions and still are. I know President Trump is selecting his cabinet now, and I don't know to what extent that goes throughout the White House and the administration. I do understand that I think Mr. Obama allowed 5 times a prayer daily in the White House. A lot of his staff is Muslim. It's been said that his Muslim ties are extensive, and I wonder if you might address, will Donald Trump be able to have, for instance, could he have prayer Bible studies in the White House, or is that not allowed? Obviously, Mr. Obama was allowed to have his prayer to the East 5 times a day, a quiet time for the White House. Do you know anything?
In the first place, I have to say that all the reports that I have seen about Obama having an Islamic prayer room and prayer 5 times a day in the White House are not from actual reliable sources. Now, I'm not saying that they're not true. I have not been in the White House. I don't know what's in there. I know that Obama clearly had great respect for Islam. But even aside from the question of whether he did that, there certainly is prayer on Capitol Hill, Islamic prayer on Capitol Hill. There's a very interesting PBS or BBC, I think it was BBC, biography of Muhammad. It came out right after 9/11 to whitewash Islam. And in the course of it, you should watch it. It's on YouTube. It's fascinating. It's a total whitewash. But there's just one little scene where they're following around this congressional staffer who's a Muslim. He works for a congressman, and he's a Muslim, and they're showing how he's a pious and devout Muslim working on Capitol Hill in Congress, in the Capitol. And they go to Islamic prayer at the Capitol. And in the room are Ibrahim Hooper and Nihad Awad of the Council on American Islamic Relations, Randall Royer, who was also with CARE at the time, who is now in prison for jihad terror plotting, and several other prominent Muslims. And you can see them. They're not identified in the show, but if you know who they are, you see them in the crowd. And then the camera pans back to show who is preaching, who's the imam at this prayer on Capitol Hill. And it's Anwar al-Maliki. And it's right there. They don't know who he is because he wasn't notorious yet. He was actually called a moderate imam right around that time in the New York Times. And so this is in case anybody doesn't know, Anwar al-Maliki was a mastermind of jihad terror plotting. He was in touch with some of the 9/11 plotters, with Nidal Malik Hassan, the Fort Hood shooter, with Abdul Farouk Abdul Muttalab, who tried to blow up an airplane over Detroit on Christmas Day 2008, I think it was, and maybe 9. In any case, he was in touch with many jihad plotters. He was killed in a drone strike. But I don't mean to get off track. The point is that I'm not sure of that story about Obama in the White House, but there's no doubt that there's tremendous infiltration and that there are many people taken as moderate Muslims who are very influential in the White House, in the Capitol, all over the U.S. government. The Islamic Society of North America and the Council on American Islamic Relations are both groups with demonstrable ties established by the Justice Department to Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood. The Obama administration last year met 325 times in the last year with representatives of CARE, even though it has been listed as an unindicted co-conspirator in a Hamas terror funding trial, and has all these other ties to Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood. He met with them almost every day last year. And that's just one example. So this is something that very much needs to be addressed and needs to be fixed. One other thing that may even be more important is that one of the things I used to do way back when I was a young man is train FBI agents and military personnel on the teachings of Islam. I would go in periodically to FBI offices, Joint Terrorism Task Force, military bases, and to have a Quran study and teach them the Quran and teach them about the life of Muhammad. Because you have to defeat an enemy you don't understand. You cannot defeat an enemy unless you have a full awareness of his beliefs, his goals, his motives, how he intends to achieve his goals, all that. You can't do it. But it's been official policy of the Obama administration since November 2011 to forbid any investigation or exploration of Islam and jihad in connection with counterterror. On October 19th, 2011, 57 Muslim and allied organizations wrote to John Brennan, the former head of the CIA, and he was actually in Homeland Security Department at that time, and they demanded that I be fired as a trainer and that all mention of Islam and jihad be scrubbed from counterterror training, and he immediately agreed. And since then, it has been the official policy of the Obama administration that there is no mention of Islam and jihad in connection with terror. Islam is a religion of peace. Jihad has nothing to do with terrorism. It's a peaceful interior struggle. And this has been the policy upon which U.S. This has been the belief upon which U.S. policy has been based. That all has to be cleared out. Oh, and President Trump actually did it the other day, said it was going to happen. He said that he's going to recast the Countering Violent Extremism program, which was Obama's euphemistic counterterror operation, as Countering Islamic Extremism. And of course, there's a huge uproar and all these people talking about white supremacists and everything, but there have been 30,000 jihad attacks worldwide since 9/11. How many white supremacist attacks have there been? I mean, it's a silly comparison. But the reality is that in doing that, President Trump is just actually trying to drain the swamp and turn this around so that we can actually deal with the enemy ideology, understand it, and thereby be able to counter it more effectively. So it is starting, but there is a great deal that needs to be done.
Joel?
Real briefly, there was a very deliberate shift in sort of, when Obama, it actually almost sort of began a little bit under Bush, but really when Obama came in, there was a very deliberate shift in terms of American foreign policy, where previously we were happy with the status quo of these various sort of third-rate autocrats. And suddenly we said, we can't be a legitimate democracy and support democracy by propping up these dictators. We will now begin relating to more moderate Islamic regimes. And so thus began, the Arab Spring sort of blows up, and there was a very deliberate effort on our part, I believe, to remove a lot of these various leaders. So, of course, Mubarak, Gaddafi, and then the effort through Benghazi, etc., was to get Assad out and to put the Muslim Brotherhood in, and they were treated as though this was a moderate group that we can relate to. And so from what I just saw the other day, Trump said, we're going to declare the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization. I mean, this is a pretty radical thing. But even to the point where you go, okay, well, so maybe we'll relate to the Muslim Brotherhood, in Egypt or something. But not only that, but they were bringing well-known Brotherhood members into government. What was the name of the fellow at DHS? there was, I mean, he was put in charge. He was the guy on his Twitter account. His Twitter image was the Rabia sign.
Oh, Muhammad Ali Biari?
Yeah. He blocked me within my first week. But anyway.
Yeah, he's a lovely guy.
But, you know, so thank God something happened and he was removed. But I think it got even too much for Obama. I mean, the guy was
He overstepped. He was distributing classified information and all sorts of things. But he was an open supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood, very high up in the Department of Homeland Security. He's just one. There are plenty others.
Yeah, so, I mean, forget bringing the fox into the chicken coop. I mean, you're bringing in the... It's a better analogy.
A gang of foxes.
Yeah, the mother of all foxes.
The thing about the declaration of the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization, which very much needs to happen, is that it would also be a staggering blow, maybe a death blow, to the Muslim Brotherhood-linked organizations in the United States, notably CARE and ISNA. And CARE and ISNA are incredibly malignant, incredibly dangerous, devastating forces. They have resisted every counterterror measure that's ever been proposed or implemented. And they have propagated this idea that resisting jihad terror is bigoted and Islamophobic and racist. You know, I mean, I'm used to it. I'm my name is Mud, and my character has been assassinated more times than Rasputin, you know. I'm dead. That's the way it is. But the worst part of it is that people who are ordinary American citizens are afraid to do something about this because they're afraid that it's racist. And that's because of CARE and ISNA. There was a plot that was actually foiled a few years back, a plot at Fort Dix, where these Muslims were going to go in and shoot the place up, kill as many American soldiers as possible before they themselves were killed. And it was foiled when they took their gory jihad videos to a video store, and they asked the clerk to transfer them from VHS to DVD. And he saw what was on the tapes, and he was very, very disturbed. And he went to his boss, and he said, "Dude, there's some terrible things on these tapes. Should I go to the police, or would that be racist?" Now, the idea that it even crossed his mind that it would be racist to oppose bloody jihad mass murderers shows the insidious influence of groups like CARE and ISNA. Luckily, he decided to be a racist, and the plot was foiled. But there are many, many others who, you know, the lovely couple, Syed Rizwan Farooq and Tashfeen Malik, the Muslim married couple who killed 15 people in San Bernardino in December 2015, there was all sorts of suspicious activity in their neighborhood, and people going and coming in the middle of the night. And they asked the neighbors after the shooting, "Why didn't you call the police?" Same answer. They didn't want to appear racist. A bunch of Muslims doing stuff in the middle of the night that looks suspicious. That would be Islamophobic to say anything about. Yeah. That's CARE. That's ISNA. That's what they do.
First, I want to ask you, will you re-announce where we can find this presentation so that we can share this with our network? And I had a few other questions.
This presentation, once it is whatever they do to those things, I will put it up at my YouTube channel, which is Jihad Watch Video, or Jihad Watch TV, I forget, one of those, but it's Jihad Watch. And it'll also be up at the site itself, jihadwatch.org, as soon as I have it. And in any case, look quickly, because there are at least 10 posts there every day, and so things go right off the front page. The best thing to do is just read the site every day.
Will you also address Sharia finance? And when you talk about coming out of the cave, I'm wondering, James Perloff wrote the book Truth is a Lonely Warrior, and Dr. Stan Monteith wrote the book Brotherhood of Darkness, which indicate that there is the, I'll just call it, the sociopathic Freemason organization that has been around for centuries to undermine civilization, we'll say, or to lead civilization into a one world kind of effort, and to undermine a free society. So my real question is, if we want to come out of the cave, we have to acknowledge this effort, and also to say to inform others that there is something to undermine through our political process. I'm not sure how to address it, really. I just know that it's there, and if we don't know about it, but as important is the Sharia finance that exists in the country right now.
Well, Sharia finance is something I know a little bit about. I don't know anything about the other thing. I've heard over the years that there is some shadowy global movement of globalization. I don't know. That may be true. I do not know. The nature of secret societies is that they're secret, and that means that there can not only it's difficult to know what they're about, but also a whole lot of speculation that might be baseless about what they're about. One thing I do know in that regard is that certainly the socialist imperative, which is dominant in Western politics these days, even though it's not usually identified as such, is a globalist internationalist movement. The idea is to establish equality, and they do it by their Procrustean bed, and so all distinctions among people have to be erased. And that means that's one of the reasons why this immigration influx is being so indefatigably supported by the left, because they want to erase all distinctions between people and make it so that every city is essentially economically and demographically the same as every other city. And then there will be peace, because what will be the point of having a war? Every place will be just as squalid, dirty, and dangerous as every other place. And so everything will be great. There will be peace. That's the globalist imperative as I see it, and that's the only one I really know about or am competent to speak about. As far as Sharia finance goes, Sharia is an all-encompassing system. There is no aspect of human life. There is not one single thing you can think of doing as a human being that Islam doesn't have laws for. And they boast about this. They say Christianity just gives you some vague moral precepts. Don't kill, don't commit adultery, don't steal. Islam gives you a rule for everything. So you always know what to do. Which, of course, is also, in a certain sense, destructive of the human spirit. And in its economic laws, it forbids usury. And usury, of course, is taking money in interest. And so the whole Western banking system is illegal under Islamic law. And so Western bankers, seeing a market that they're missing and wanting to make money, they have introduced Sharia finance into the West, where there is Sharia-compliant banking that's readily available in the U.S. and in Europe. And you can buy a house without any interest, and you can get interest-free loans and so on, so as nothing violates Islamic law. Now, the two worst aspects of this is that it is one more accommodation of Islamic law in the West. And Islamic law covers everything, remember. So once you establish the precedent that Islamic law is something that ought to be accommodated, where do you stop? Where do you say, well, that much Sharia is okay, but no more? You guys can't bring that part of Sharia in. And then they'll say, why not? You let us have Sharia finance. You let us extinguish the freedom of speech and destroy criticism of Islam and criminalize it. So why can't we do stoning adulterers? Why can't we do amputating the hands of thieves? Etc., etc. Why can't we make women wear the cloth coffin? Why not? And so the problem is one of accommodation and of the slope that leads to in terms of adopting all of Sharia eventually. Also, in a practical sense, these banks are very stupid in having these Sharia finance boards that are made up of imams, and the imams are generally connected with groups like CARE and ISNA. And so they're letting in people with ties to Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood into their highest leadership, which is something that they will probably regret one day.
The rabbi has a question.
It's actually not a question. I just wanted to clarify something that happened in Gush Katif. Gush Katif it couldn't be sustained. Israel has limited resources, and there were 8,000 or 9,000 troops that had to be maintained there continually. And so it was used as a PR, as well as, it was like the Sinai. We conquered the Sinai, but there was no way to maintain it. And so we gave it back as a gesture. Gush Katif, although it was extraordinarily successful and somewhere in the neighborhood of 20% of Israel's GNP, it just couldn't be sustained, the amount of effort, the troops that had to be there to protect them. And I listened to Joel this morning, and I listened to Joel this evening. The only way that I've seen, and we have seen a great deal of success, is the love of Messiah. That conquers that fear. We have a brother here tonight who went over to North Africa, Sierra Leone, to work with Ebola. He ended up preaching there. He ended up leading in excess of 300 Muslims to the Lord that night. They saw the effort of people outside their own, and they were drawn by the love of Messiah. And I just wanted to affirm what Joel was saying, that the superiority of love over fear and hate is what draws people. It's what drew me. I'm sure it's what drew many of the people in this room. And that's all.
There's just one note about Gush Katif that I'd like to add to that. You're no doubt exactly right, and it wasn't sustainable, at least at this time. If it had been framed as such, as a tactical necessity, then I think there would have been no problem. Military tactics can make for some hard choices for the long-term good. The problem with it was that it was nearly universally framed, as far as I saw, as something that would bring about peace, based on the assumption that the Palestinians just needed a little bit of land, and if the Israelis made this concession, then peace would ensue.
That was
the
PR.
Yeah, and that is very damaging kind of PR, because it establishes a precedent that if Israel just makes more concessions, gives up the settlements, gives up East Jerusalem, the Temple Mount, whatever, Jerusalem goes back to the way it was before 1967, then there will be peace. There won't be peace if Israel does all that any more than there was after Gaza, for the same reason. The jihad imperative is maximalist.
I agree, but like I say, there was no bridge.
Understood.
It was an island, and to get there, there were nothing but sniper attacks, etc.
Tactically, it may have been exactly the right thing to do and the only thing to do, but then it should have been presented just as such.
I agree.
It's the same thing with, a lot of, it's very popular today to, for Christians to engage Muslims in what they call interfaith dialogue. And it's funny how the concessions are always exclusive. Like, you get all these Christians to get together, they're so proud that they are sitting there with some imams. They go, hey, look, I'm engaging, and, you know, this sort of thing. But inevitably, it always ends up with the Christians making all kinds of concessions, and the Muslims never budge a single inch. You go, okay, so we just gathered together, but, you know, the Christian pastor said, well, we worship the same God, you know, or they refer to Muhammad as the prophet, or, you know, whatever it might be. There's always some joint declaration, and it's always a compromise of some of the essentials on the Christian's part. Why? It's the same thing. And then they say, we need to get together. If you guys want to prove that you're actually tolerant and loving and so forth, we're going to get together again. And then they do it again, and the Christians give in a bit more. And so it's the same thing in the political arena with Israel as it is with the church. And it always ends up with we all get together and hold hands and look how magnanimous we are and sing Kumbaya.
We don't allow that here.
This interfaith dialogue. Just a note about the interfaith dialogue. It's really a very pernicious thing. And it's funny. We were talking. Joel and I were talking in the car earlier about Protestant polemic against the Catholic Church, saying that the Catholic Church is the great harlot of the Book of Revelation or the Whore of Babylon. And I always used to think that was very silly, but then came Pope Francis. Yeah. Now I realize they were right all along. But seriously, though, the dialogue is an extraordinarily self-defeating thing. And two incidents, actually, from the UK, very recent incidents, indicate that. In the Scottish Episcopal Church, which is not very large, the established church in Scotland, They actually, in the cathedral in Glasgow, for Christmas, had a Muslim read from the Quran chapter 19. And the Quran in chapter 19 is describing the virgin birth. But it ends up with this verse. This is Jesus, the son of Mary. And this is the truth about him concerning which they are in doubt. That's the Christians. It does not befit Allah to take for himself a son. Glory be to him. When he decrees a thing, he only says be, and it is. It's chapter 19, verses 34 and 35. Now, that was read out in the Glasgow Cathedral, a denial of Jesus as the Son of God. So a denial of a core element of the Christian faith was read out in a Christian church. How many times do you think that Christians have gone into mosques anywhere in the world and read about the Son of God being born? Absolutely none. The concessions are, as Joel said, always on the Christian side. Not only that, but the Queen's chaplain, I believe his name is Ashenden. Anyway, he spoke out against this and received a storm of criticism and abuse and was forced to resign. And not long after that, another cathedral in Britain not only read from the Quran, but had the Islamic call to prayer. The Islamic call to prayer right there from the altar. Now, let me tell you something. On May 29th, 1453, the greatest, grandest church, the greatest cathedral in the whole Christian world, the Hagia Sophia in Constantinople, was conquered and turned into a mosque. How was it turned into a mosque? The invading armies, the Muslim armies that had conquered Constantinople that day, Mehmet the Conqueror, the Sultan, the Caliph, went into the church with a muezzin, the guy who calls the Muslims to prayer, and he went up into the pulpit and he proclaimed the Islamic call to prayer, and that made the church a mosque. So if you don't think that there are Muslims all over Britain now who believe that the cathedral where that call to prayer took place is now a mosque, you're naive. And they will come back and claim it eventually. In the meantime, the call to prayer includes the first chapter of the Quran, the Fatiha, which concludes with these words: guide us to the straight path, the path of those who have earned your favor, not the path of those who have earned your anger, or the path of those who've gone astray. And almost universally, Islamic exegetes explain that the path of those who've earned your anger is the Jews, and the path of those who've gone astray are the Christians. So the Christians and Jews were cursed from the altar of a Christian cathedral in a Christian, supposedly Christian country, in the name of dialogue. This is what dialogue is about.
I want to thank you for giving us an amazing history lesson tonight.
Thank you.
But I'm going to ask you to be a chess master and look several steps ahead.
I was always terrible at chess.
Okay, checkers. I have been somewhat pessimistic in the latest years. I have said there will be a day when we in America as one will stand up and say, we can no longer allow these people to be among us. And on that day, it will be too late. Now, I don't want to be there. Show me an exit plan. What are their next steps and what should ours be?
Their next steps are quite clear, because they followed the same path in Europe. As Joel said earlier, we're 20 years behind. But it's coming. That there are areas of Europe where the authorities don't even dare to go in. Police and firemen don't dare to go in. And Islamic law essentially prevails. There will be areas like that in the U.S. It's already happened in Dearborn, Michigan. You may know, several years ago, there were some Christian evangelists who went into an Arab festival. It was an Arab festival, not a Muslim festival. And they were arrested for preaching about Christianity, which is not illegal in the United States. It's illegal under Islamic law. And that happened in the United States. Now, of course, the whole thing went to court and the charges were dropped. But the fact that they were arrested at all in Dearborn, Michigan, indicates that Dearborn authorities are largely already far too much influenced by Sharia than they ought to be. We're going to see a lot more of that, not less. Unless, of course, President Trump begins a massive reversal of all this. But ultimately they will assert more and more of Islamic law here and demand that it be accommodated. I was debating an imam a few years back at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and I went into the men's room, and there was a foot bath in there for Muslims to wash their feet before they do the prayers. I looked around. I didn't see any holy water fonts. I didn't see any Torah scrolls. It was very strange. It was this public university had only made accommodation for Islamic religious practice. And this kind of thing is get sold under the banner of diversity and so on. There will be more and more of that, unless it is challenged and rebuked and it stops. Now, what can we do in the short term? We can call upon these American Muslim groups, and there needs to be a national movement to do this, to repudiate the aspects of Islam that are incompatible with the Constitution. We constantly hear about the First Amendment. I'm constantly asked, how can you be saying this? Doesn't it violate their First Amendment rights if you move too energetically against jihad? Absolutely not. The First Amendment is not some kind of a license to commit treason or sedition or subversion. The First Amendment is designed to protect the United States, not destroy it. And if the Muslim groups in the United States are preaching that the United States Constitution needs to be replaced by Sharia, and that women deserve fewer rights than men, and that non-Muslims need to be denied basic rights, and that disobedient women should be beaten, and so many other things in Islam that are violations of American law, then they need to be prosecuted as such and made very clear that these kinds of things will not be tolerated here, that they need to reform or these things will be prosecuted. Now, nothing like this is being done because it's all religious freedom. But I think religious freedom ends where treason and subversion and violation of existing American laws begins.
That's right.
Yes.
And that they condemn, they say they condemn all the American Muslim groups. They say they condemn Al-Qaeda and ISIS and all the rest of them. So let them back up that condemnation with action. Do you know that there's not a single mosque in the United States that has a program to teach young Muslims why they should reject the understanding of Islam that Al-Qaeda offers? Why not? If they say they reject it, why aren't they trying to prevent young Muslims from joining, since there have been plenty of American Muslims who have joined? So we need to see those kinds of programs. This is just a very short-term practical measure, but it could do a tremendous good amount of good in turning things around.
I just, you know, in terms of playing chess, I'm actually, the past 20 years or so, I've been incredibly politically oriented, but it was really 8 years ago where I finally just said, I'm done. You know, I have no confidence in the political process whatsoever. And I literally, I'll be honest with you, for the past 8 years, I didn't listen to a single speech that the president gave because I just said, I can't, for my own emotional well-being, I can't deal with this anymore. And I just completely abandoned any hope in politics whatsoever. And so what I essentially said is, I said, but, you know, I don't believe in hopelessness. And I said, I do believe I have a weapon in my arsenal at my disposal, which is the gospel. And I'm going to focus on that. And I believe that one has an eternal implications, and it can win. I mean, look at right now, Iran, 20% growth of the church every year. Fastest growing church in the world. Iran! 20 years, what, Iran's going to be a Christian nation, and we're going to be a bunch of transgender Sharia law. But now, I go, wait a minute, oh my goodness, like, I'll be honest with you, I met Mike Pence a couple weeks before the election. I actually gave, talking about Bible studies in the White, I gave, I shouldn't say this on tape. I gave him a copy of one of my books, I'll just say that. And I didn't think the guy was going to win. I was just like, oh yeah, I'm meeting governor of Illinois, you know, I was not like, I'm going to meet the next vice president. Like, I just did not believe this, this is so surreal. And all of a sudden I'm like, wait a minute, maybe my cynicism, my complete pessimism was slightly misplaced. But again, I still don't have long-term faith in the political process. However, that said, I know it's, but then this, and on the other hand, but It's kind of like in the scriptures where it says the hand should not say to the eye, hey, I don't need you. I only have so much energy. You know, I know I'm 45, but still, I have energy for the gospel. That's what I'm primarily going to focus on with the time that I have. But there are those that are called to the political process and to give themselves to that, and it's necessary. That's not something we abandon. As the believing community, we need to make that one of our priorities. Now, our overarching priority is the gospel, because that's going to have the longest, you know, eternal implications. But we can't abandon the political process and all of the stuff that comes with that. So we need to have a comprehensive approach, again, but we need to have our priorities right in terms of the big picture of the political. Ultimately, we can elect all the wonderful politicians, and we can establish all the laws and expect all of these pagans to start behaving. But that's not how it works. You know, you don't just put external laws on people and suddenly they reform. The model of the gospel is it transforms the heart from the inside out. If we actually preach the gospel and do what we're supposed to do, then you get 10,000 new converts. They're going to start naturally electing more righteous leaders and embrace righteous laws. You know, it's from the ground up. And, you know, so we need to kind of understand how this whole process works and get our priorities right. But it has to be a comprehensive approach. The reality is we're going to make 3 steps forward. We're going to go 5 steps back, 3 steps forward, 5 steps back, 3 steps forward, 10 steps back. We all get killed. Jesus comes back, establishes his kingdom. It's all good. That's sort of the long term.
In the interest of the both and, rather than either or approach, I would actually... not contradicting anything Joel has said, that's all very true and wise and important. At the same time, one of the things to remember as well, Egypt right now is between 6-10% Christian. When the Muslims invaded in the 7th century, it was 99% Christian. Where did all the Christians go? Did they move away? No. They converted to Islam. They converted to Islam over the years. Why? Because they thought Muhammad was wonderful and the Quran was eloquent and beautiful? No. They converted to Islam because they were subjugated under Islamic law, made to pay a tax, made to live with various humiliating and discriminatory regulations, and all they had to do to get rid of all this aggravation and oppression and suffering was convert to Islam. So most of them did over the years. And the remnant, the 6-10%, they are to be commended and honored because of the fact that they and their fathers and their fathers and their mothers and their grandmothers, they have held out for 14 centuries in the midst of an ongoing atmosphere of low-level and sometimes high-level persecution. It's a suffering, martyr church, and we owe every bit of support that we can to give it. But the thing is, why did that happen? Egypt was part of the Byzantine Empire in the 7th century, and the Byzantine Empire had fought a series of wars with the other great power in the world, the Persian Empire. Right at the end of the 6th century and the beginning of the 7th century. In other words, right before Islam. And at the time of the beginnings of what we know of as Islam, I think actually Islamic theology developed later, but that's another story. But the beginning of the Arab conquests, the Byzantine Empire nominally ruled Egypt, but did not have enough troops to protect it. And so was completely overwhelmed by the Arab armies. If they had had a decent army in Egypt, we might not be talking about Islam today. Now, that is not to contradict anything about. This is spiritual warfare. This is spiritual warfare of the highest level. And it has to be met with spiritual means. But there is, just as in the incarnation, the Lord is both divine and human, there is a divine and human aspect to this. And we need to make sure that we do not suffer the fate of Egypt and become a suffering martyr church that we will be substantially reduced, because that is exactly what they want for us and exactly what they are trying to bring about. And it would be armies that could stop them, just like the armies that the Egyptian Christians wished they had had at that time. Not only armies, and not armies without the spiritual aspect, but yes, armies too. Remember Churchill saying that we can live easily and comfortably because rough men stay awake at night and protect us.
Yeah.
And we need a lot of those rough men now. Not the transgenders going into a box. Hoorah!
It's really the same thing with Constantinople, too. It's incredibly sad in that, you know, there have been many efforts to take Constantinople, and they repeatedly failed. And yes, you had sort of the development of gunpowder and, again, the fullness of time, but really it was ultimately the Europe, the Christian nations were so divided that they didn't send any backup. And you just have this sort of struggling little group there to hold the fort. And if some Western or even Eastern European nations had sent help, they could have easily cast off Mehmet and his crew. But it was really just a matter of a lack of unity among them.
Yeah, remember the Council of Florence. The Council of Florence was an ecumenical council of the church designed to reunite the church. Reunite, that is, the Catholic Church in Rome with the Orthodox Church in Constantinople. They had been in schism with each other for 400 years. And it failed. And it failed definitively by about the year 1438. And it was 15 years after that, in 1453, that Constantinople fell. And so Joel is absolutely right. The Pope was not willing or interested in calling a crusade and sending troops over to protect Constantinople. And so this is the fix that we're in because of this kind of disunity.
First of all, I want to say thank you, Joel, for your answer, saying that you believe that the gospel was the answer. It's interesting, I was wanting to ask a question here, and both of you made answers that kind of encouraged me to speak out now. You, Robert, said that we needed more men awake at night on their knees. The verse that's been on my heart all night is the one that says we war not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers in high places. So our war isn't really against the human beings that are deceived by Islam, but it's against the principalities and powers.
Here again, I say it's both and, not either or. That's all.
Right. I'm extremely proud of the fact that our pastor has, within the past few months, started having prayer meetings once a month, even before the election. And for people that don't know, even before the election, Franklin Graham went around the entire nation to every major city having prayer revivals for praying for the election before the election even occurred. And I'm a firm believer that a lot of what's going on is because of a lot of people praying.
Amen.
And I hope we continue to pray. I'm a firm believer that the most powerful weapon we have is not anything other than prayer. I think an hour of prayer is more powerful than a month worth of fighting. And so, saying all that, I'm kind of asking you guys for wisdom on how those of us that believe in the power of prayer can direct those prayers and say the right prayers that will help bring revival to our nation, because that's the only thing that's going to save us.
Just pray in tongues.
I tend to think that the Lord's Prayer is the most effective prayer of all the prayers, because we pray that God's will be done. And we know that God is good. We know that God is not a law. And so God does wish good for us. And it is human beings who interfere with that being accomplished. So I think that the more that we pray the Lord's Prayer and pray in the spirit of the Lord's Prayer, that is the best thing that we need at this point.
Yes, again, thank you very much for your tremendous speeches tonight. On the other hand, the thing that concerns me the most is the Muslim community itself. There's over a billion or so Muslims in this world. What are they doing, and why aren't they doing something about what's happening? I mean, this is their responsibility more than it is ours. Ours is a defensive one. Theirs should be their own.
you're absolutely right, but they're not doing anything, and you're absolutely right about that. I track that on Jihad Watch also. There have been, here and there over the years, various demonstrations, Muslims against ISIS, Muslims against terrorism. Invariably, they attract 25 people, 50 people, tiny crowds. But by contrast, when the cartoonists of Muhammad were massacred in Paris in January 2015, there were huge demonstrations all over the world, not against the murders, but against the cartoonists. 800,000 Muslims demonstrated in Chechnya against drawing Muhammad. Tens of thousands in Pakistan, Iran, elsewhere. We've never seen these kinds of crowds in anti-terror demonstrations by Muslims. The answer for that is very simple. The Quran teaches warfare, violence, hatred of the unbelievers. So when there are these people who are warlike, violent, and hate the unbelievers, and they're Muslims, and you are a Muslim who doesn't hate unbelievers and doesn't want to wage jihad, but just wants to do your job and take care of your family, you're not going to speak out against them because you know they're right if you know your religion. You know that the book says what they do is right. And also that if you complain about it, you yourself could be killed as a heretic or apostate. And so Muslims don't do anything. They do speak out, sort of, in the United States. All the major Muslim groups have condemned the jihadi groups, and they condemn every terror attack that happens. But what are they doing to stop them? Nothing. And they're not going to, because this is in the religion. I have, for so many years now, since 9/11, I see articles coming down the pike every few weeks, or even more frequently. It's time for moderate Muslims to step up. Well, really? It's 15 years after 9/11. You're still waiting for that? Get a clue. And so the hope for in all that, and there is hope, is that Islam is a totalitarian system, and it does have a death penalty for those who leave. And so while it appears that there are 1 billion Muslims, they're actually not, or 1.6 billion. There are fewer than the number that we have, because there are many hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, of Muslims who are not really Muslims. But they go along, and they don't say anything, but they are secretly Christians, or secretly atheists, or secretly something else. And they are not going to help the jihad. Now, ultimately, I'm not saying we should put our hope in such people. But the strength of the Islamic world is not really what it appears to be. That's all. And so that is some reason for it.
I just wanted to mention, Joel, you had said that we have lost, the church has lost its confidence in the message, in the gospel. And I think the answer, or the reason is because the church is asleep and is not teaching. It's not teaching what we need to know. People do not know how to answer. I think of Nabil Qureshi, who had in his dorm room a Christian who could answer back the things that he spoke about Islam. And they're few and far between. We aren't teaching.
That's a huge thing. That's a very important problem. I know we got to stop, but I'll be brief. The churches in general, Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox, I don't know of any church that has any kind of program to teach young people how to counter Dawah, Islamic proselytizing. And yet, Muslims are making concerted efforts to convert Christian young people. And this is a grave omission that has to be addressed. You look at some of the highest profile Muslims, John Walker Lind, the American who was found fighting alongside Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan, and Adam Gadon, who was very high up in Al-Qaeda. These were people who were raised in nominally Christian homes, who were completely susceptible to Islamic proselytizing. Every young Christian ought to be able to answer the Islamic arguments. And that's the responsibility of the churches that they've tremendously failed to take up, but need to.
What do you say we end by praying the Lord's Prayer? That's, I'll just go ahead and just read it, and everyone can pray out loud. I think I have the NIV. That still counts, right? Let's go ahead. Let's everyone stand up. This then is how you should pray. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts, as we have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil.